Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 373 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyree, your host, as usual. And today, I'm very happy to have my good friend, Joey Coleman, on once again. If you were with us a couple of weeks ago, you might have heard the classic rewind version of when we had Joey on before, which was episode 219. So a good 160 some odd episodes ago, back in June of 2020. And that's when we had him on to talk about his first book, Never Lose a Customer Again. And we are having him back today as a very special treat to help promote the release of his book tomorrow, a second book called Never Lose an Employee Again. And I've said this on many occasions, that Joey's first book, to me, was the single greatest business development book that I ever read. It's the only one that caused me to take massive action, and I think it's directly responsible for whatever success I've had with my law firm since that, in the last 3 years. And I have no doubt that the same experience is going to be felt by me with this new book, Never Lose an Employee Again, because it addresses that fundamental question we have right now about how are we going to staff our law firms? How are we going to find fabulous employees? And what are we going to do towards keeping them? And as I know from Joey's first book, this book's going to have all the framework and the process necessary for you to take dramatic action, as I did with the first one. So I'm very excited to spend the next 40 minutes or so with my friend Joey Coleman, and we're going to talk about Never Lose an Employee Again. Joey Coleman, welcome back to The Law Entrepreneur.
Neil, it is a pleasure to be back. Thanks for having me join for round two, and thanks to everybody for listening in yet again as Neil and I dive into fun experience topics.
Well, you know, an understatement to say that I'm delighted to have you back. I seem to say that to everybody, but I'm really delighted to have Joey back. Full disclosure, I count Joey as a friend. I have touted his first book, Never Lose a Customer Again, as, in my humble opinion, honestly, I'm not telling you this just because you're on the podcast. I honestly feel it's the best business development book that I ever read. It's the sole book that I actually spent a lot of time implementing in my own practice, rather than just reading the book and, you know, tossing off the ideas that, you know, being kind of interesting. And I think I've probably given away 36 copies of the book.
I so appreciate it, Neil. You're the best.
So really, to have you back on to talk about the new book, which is what we're going to spend time talking about, is my delight. So before we get started with that, Joey, tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Yeah, so what's probably most interesting to your audience, Neil, is that I'm a recovering attorney. The first step is admitting you have a problem. There's 11 steps after that.
Exactly right.
You know, but I used to be a criminal defense lawyer. I worked in the executive branch for both the White House, the Secret Service, and the CIA. I did business consulting. I ran an ad agency for 15 years. You know, taught at the postgraduate level. But for the last 15 years now, I have been teaching companies around the world how to keep their customers and how to keep their employees by really focusing on the experiences that you create and how to string a series of experiences together over the course of a relationship to make a customer want to continue to do business with you or to make an employee want to continue to be in your employ. And so I would say the bulk of the last 15, almost 20 years now has been all around creating remarkable experiences and trying to teach folks how to do that in their own organization.
Well, one of the things I like the best about the first book is its construct, how you move from phase to phase, from step to step with these concrete examples and really actionable takeaways at each phase. What's that phrase that I'm going to have this backward, that every blog post should be a tweet, every magazine article should be a blog post, and every book should be a magazine article, right?
Nice,
too many authors just pad the hell out of, admittedly, you know, a good idea, but you as a reader know you're 50%, 20% of the way through the book, you know the author's shot is what? I mean, that's it. The rest of these pages are just reamplification of the same point. I never once felt that way with your book.
I'm so glad to hear that, Neil. I mean, that was certainly my goal, you know, and to your point, I think one of the things that I really try to do as a writer is recognize that there are three different types of writers and speakers, right? There are writers and speakers who make, you know, are trying to make you think differently. There are writers and speakers who are trying to make you feel differently. And then there are writers and speakers who are trying to make you act differently. And while I certainly want my audiences and my readers and my listeners to think differently and feel differently, if you don't act differently, I don't feel like I've earned your investment of time or effort. And so I really try to write books that are built around frameworks that are evergreen, that are easy to implement, that don't require a huge investment of dollars. And I guess the recovering attorney in me wants them to be very evidence-based. So when we wrote the first book, there were over 46 case studies. And when we were getting ready to do the next book, the new book, which is called Never Lose an Employee Again, my personal goal was, all right, we need a minimum of 50 case studies. And I want to see if I can be the first business book, to my knowledge. And if there's one out there that's also fits this criteria, folks, please let me know. But I don't think there's ever been a business book written that has a case study, at least one case study from all seven continents.
And
mine does. And it's for a reason. It's not just a catchy promotional or, you know, thing for people to remember, as much as it is to try to impress upon the readers and the listeners that employee experience, while certainly having variations depending on what country you're in, what culture you're a part of, what industry you serve, etc., has a lot of underlying principles and traits that can be applied broadly across all humans. And the reason for that is because all employees are human. And so I think there's a real opportunity to learn from different industries, different cultures, different countries, and apply things that might be more normal or more frequent or more familiar in those jurisdictions and environments into our own practices in a way that will help us stand out in the marketplace.
Well, that's one of the things that I really liked about the first book, that, as I said, the construct. You know, you read so many books and listen to so many authors, and I can hear attorneys all over the country saying to themselves, yeah, that works in that industry, or yeah, that works for that, you know, or that works for that level of success in the legal practice. Yeah, if I had 25 employees and the revenue that 25 employees created, I could do a lot of really remarkable things. But what I really liked about your construct is that it scaled from the true solo practitioner, which I was at the time, to, you know, a multinational law firm. The framework works the same, regardless.
Absolutely. Absolutely,
and
Neil.
It seems to also be true for the new book.
100%. I tried to write a book that was as valuable to the person hiring their first employee as the person hiring their 10,000th employee. And while certainly, as we know, as we increase in size and scale, the magnitude of our problems and our situations and our challenges increases, the practical reality is that our systems should be built on fundamental principles that work whether we're hiring our first or our thousandth. And that's definitely something that I tried to do. And I was really thrilled that the great majority of the case studies in the book come from the 90%+ of businesses on the planet that have fewer than 100 employees. Because to your point, I didn't want people reading a case study about, you know, Best Buy as an employer, for example, which is a case study in the book, and saying, but Joey, I don't have hundreds of thousands of employees, you know, operating in multiple countries all over the world, or Pepsi, which is a case study in the book, or anybody like that. I wanted them to read case studies where they're like, oh, this company has 12 employees. Yeah, I have 12 employees. Yeah. This feels like my world. Or, oh, this is a company that's entirely remote and they only get together in person once a year. Oh, that's kind of like my company. Or this company is a bricks and mortar company where everybody comes to the office every day and we do something that's more akin to physical manual labor. Oh, there's an example in the book that is similar to that for me. And as a result, I think my goal certainly was to have people be able to find multiple parallels to their business in the pages of this book.
Yeah. Well, let's drill down a little bit, because the first book, for those of you who haven't read it, deals exclusively with the customer experience and how businesses lead or can lead the customer through this framework of experiences, culminating in having a client, a customer, who is going to be with you forever and rave about you and promote you and be an advocate on your behalf. And it's a self-fulfilling kind of marketing wheel, although it's not done for marketing purposes. How did you get from customer experience to employee experience? When you were writing the first book, were you kind of thinking about that down the line? Was that revealing itself to you, or how did that come about?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Neil, it came about in two ways. I mean, as somebody who has spent a lot of time in customer experience, consulting, writing, speaking, teaching, I recognized pretty early on that your customer experience is only ever going to be as great as your employee experience. Because as a general rule, your employees are the ones delivering the experience to the customers.
Sure.
But I have to admit, even though I understood that these were in many ways two sides of the same coin, you know, as you improve the customer experience, the employee experience goes up. As the employee experience falls, the customer experience falls. While I recognize that maybe cognitively, I didn't recognize it as emotionally. And the reason for that, to be completely candid, is at the time I was writing the first book, I was a solo entrepreneur. I didn't have any employees. I had previously had employees when I practiced law, when I ran my ad agency, et cetera. But I had been far enough removed for that that I, to be candid, had forgotten how challenging it is to be an owner with employees that you're trying to manage and, you know, direct and work together and support and kind of get moving in the same direction. And what happened is a couple months after my first book came out, I got an email, and all the email said was, "Dear Joey, if you wrote a book called Never Lose an Employee Again, I would buy it." Signed, The Reader. That's all it said. And I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. Never really thought about writing a whole book about that, but oh, that's okay. And I just, to be honest, I kind of filed it in the long list of, well, that's an interesting idea.
Yeah, noted it. Move on.
I received about a dozen more emails just like that. All they said, "Dear Joey," these are emails from people I didn't know, who were readers of my first book I'd never met, I'd never had any interaction before or since, frankly, that just said, "Dear Joey, if you wrote a book called Never Lose an Employee Again, I would buy it." And after I received about the dozen one, as my lovely wife Barrett will tell you, you know, I'll get there eventually, I thought, there might be something here I should be paying attention to. You've told me almost a dozen times. And so I started to get into the research. And I started to explore this. And Neil, I found two things. Number one, the problem, the challenge being faced by so many employers globally was even greater than I had realized. See earlier comment about being kind of disconnected yeah. from it because I was a solo entrepreneur. And number two, COVID came along. Yeah. And when COVID came along, I actually called my publisher and I said, you know, stop the presses. Hang on. We're going to write this book in a longer fashion than we were going to before. Because I think what is happening with this pandemic is we are going to see a fundamental shift in the way employees experience their employers and vice versa. And Neil, to be candid, I'm so glad I did, because I think the practical reality is post-COVID, the world of employer-employee relationships has not only changed dramatically, but it is never going back to the way it was. No. And I know that may be very disconcerting for some people to hear. And I know that may be very frustrating. And I'm sorry to be the bearer of that bad news. If you see it as bad news, I see it as a resetting of relationships that was long overdue. And that those employers who are willing to reset their expectations for employee contributions, employee relationships, and those employees who are willing to reset their expectations for employee contributions and employee-employer relations, those folks that are willing to do that are going to experience a level of success, opportunity, and possibility that was heretofore unfathomable, but now is possible because of the dramatic sea change in how people think about work.
Well, I think when the first book came out, its success was due in some part to the fact that it was the exact book that was needed for the exact time. I mean, we had you on almost 3 years ago to the day to talk about your first book. You were on in June of 2020. When was the first one
came out in April of 2018. So it had come out almost 2 years before that.
Okay. And, you know, if we think about what the business world was like in the early 2000s, I think it's pretty safe to say it was an explosion of opportunity. I think so many businesses were created that took advantage of advances in technology and interaction, direct business to consumer interaction. That if you didn't pay attention to the customer experience, you weren't going to be able to compete with those who did. And similarly, I think with the new book here, you know, that's all we hear in the streets right now. You know, when you talk to business colleagues, the only thing people are talking about is how difficult it is to find and retain qualified employees. So I think the book is going to be very successful for largely the same reason. It's the book that's needed, right?
Oh, well, I appreciate that, Neil. Yeah, and you're absolutely right. I mean, in terms of the conversations I'm having out in the world with employers, what I hear are a couple of things. Number one, we can't find great people. Number two, we get great people to start, but they seem to leave almost as quickly as we bring them in the front door, they run out the back. I talk to people and they say, you know, Joey, we're just having such difficulty creating any semblance of long-term engagement with our team and with our staff. And on top of all of that, we seem to have a gigantic cloud of uncertainty around, should folks come to the office? Should they work remotely? Should it be a hybrid situation? What, you know what I mean? And no one, respectfully, seems to have figured this out. And I think the reason why no one has figured this out is it's going to be different for every company and every group of people working in that company. And the age-old theory of we're going to run an office of humans the same way we ran a factory of assembly line workers, it was a flawed premise from the outset. And the practical reality is you don't need everyone under the same roof from 9 to 5 every single day. Now, don't get me wrong. I am not an advocate for purely remote businesses that never interact with those folks. But I am also not an advocate for, well, you don't understand. We've always done it this way. People commute. They come to work. They sit in their cubicle from 9 to 5 and then they go home. Each of those philosophies is equally archaic in 2023 and beyond. Each of those approaches is not going to be the pat answer to the question of what should your workplace look like. And the opportunity, to your point, I think that is available to employers globally is to think strategically, think empathetically, and think compassionately about how do we want to structure the relationship our employees have with the office, the work they do, and their coworkers. And when we come from that approach, there's a lot of possibility.
Well, I hear a lot about creating the corporate culture or, you know, the law firm culture. I want to create a culture that supports, you know, the lofty goals and ideals that I have as an employer. But we seldom see blueprints for how to
sure.
And a lot of lip service about it, but very few, you know, engineering drawings on how to create that culture. And what I take away from the new book here is that when you want to talk about company culture, you're talking about how do you treat your employees? What's the relationship between the employer and employer? That is the culture of your business.
Exactly. And what is it like to come to work? What is it like to interact with your boss, with your colleagues, with your direct reports? Those human interactions in that environmental enclave of the thing called work, that is your culture. Culture is not foosball tables. Culture is not free lunch.
Amen.
Culture is not X numbers of vacation per year. No, culture, it includes those things. That's a piece of the puzzle. But culture, in my opinion, really is how do your employees feel about the work they're doing in the industry they're operating with the people they're collaborating with? And that feeling, which I get is more amorphous, is more difficult to define, that is what your culture is. You shouldn't be able to write your culture in a paragraph. That's right. That's not the way it works. And to your point, in the same way that folks will say, as it relates to children, you know, more is caught than taught, right? So all these parents, and I am a parent of two young boys, a 7-year-old and a 9-year-old, you know, one of the things my amazing wife, Barrett, and I talk about all the time is how can we try to be an example to our boys instead of trying to say, you should behave like this? How can we show them from our interactions, from our behavior that like, oh, this is the model that we're trying to have you adopt and follow and agree with? And I think the same holds true in organizations. It never ceases to amaze me, especially in law firms. And I say this having worked in multiple law firms, you know, this idea of, well, the associates need to just know that they need to put in their time. And then if they're willing to bill 2,000 hours a year, for a decade, they'll make partner. Well, here's the thing. When you, Miss Partner, Mr. Partner, were an associate, did you like that model? Probably not.
Yeah.
Did you just accept that model because that was the only way to do it? Probably. But that doesn't mean it was right. And it doesn't mean it was sustainable. And it doesn't mean it was creating the kind of culture of collaboration and support and encouragement. Instead, it's creating a culture of scarcity, overwhelm, overwork, and unappreciation. And so if it wasn't working when you were going through it, why are you still perpetuating that same belief system? I understand the personal thought of, oh, but you know, I walked to school both ways, uphill and snow, right? Like, I get it. And sorry. The environment we create for the people following us should be better than the environment we had to go through. Not the same. It shouldn't be that, well, because I had to put up with this ridiculousness, you have to prove that you can put up with this. Why? If you thought it was ridiculous the first time through, why not take the steps to make it better for those that follow? That is how humanity has progressed as a species since the beginning of time. Since we crawled out of the primordial ooze, The idea is what we're creating is better for the next generation. That seems to work in so many areas of our life, except the workplace. And especially as it relates, forgive me, to law firms. Like law firms in some ways are the slowest to change on this stuff.
Support for today's episode comes from Ruby, the number one client communication solution for growing legal practices. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, Ruby creates exceptional experiences for your callers and website visitors. They take messages, screen and transfer callers, schedule appointments, perform new client intake, confirm details with outbound calls, and can answer in English and Spanish, and a whole lot more. Just like an in-house receptionist, only better, because they turn every ring into a relationship. Ruby can work full-time, part-time, or as a backup, and you can change your instructions anytime with their top-rated mobile app and online dashboard. Plus, Ruby integrates with tools such as Clio, LexiClara, MyCase, and Rocket Matter. It all adds up to more opportunities and more time saved. In fact, 90% of legal professionals who use Ruby capture more billable hours than the national average, with many recording double or more. That's five or more billable hours per day. To experience the Ruby difference for yourself, visit get.ruby.com/ELE. That's get.ruby.com/TLE, as in the law entrepreneur, for up to $150 off your first month. Imagine you, powered by Ruby. As a law firm owner, you take responsibility for driving more revenue for your firm. But how much of that revenue ends up as bottom line profit? Ryan Kimmler, the net profit CFO, helps law firms drive more top line revenue to bottom line profit. His two game-changing tools are the scorecard, so you can actually know what your numbers are and can make informed decisions, and the action plan, so you know how to get your numbers where you want them to be and drive more net profit. To learn more about Ryan, check out episode 306 of The Law Entrepreneur, and you can get a free profit acceleration call by going to go.oncehub, that's O-N-C-E-H-U-B, go.oncehub.com/profit. I will also tell you, just as an aside, I am a client of Ryan's. I've been working with him for the past 6 months. Frankly, ever since he did that episode with me, I signed on with him to be a client. And I've been thrilled with the kind of information and insight he's been able to give me. So do yourself a favor, you know, get that free call and check out Ryan Kimmler at netprofit.com. Well, I've mentioned this many times on the podcast. After the pandemic and we started things getting back to normal, I heard so many law firm employers saying, I want them back in the office where I can watch what they're doing, where I can see that they're working. I'm like, well, yeah, that's not the problem.
Yeah, no, that's not the problem. And let's stop and deconstruct the identity that comes from, I want to be able to look out on my fiefdom and see people in cubicles work.
I want to know that they're working for the amount of money I'm paying them with what I heard.
Yeah, absolutely. And here's the thing. If you have decided to associate the value of your employees to be equated to the hours they sit at a desk, my question is why? And has that metric been that successful of a metric in the past? Even just in your own life, leaders, think about the amount of times that, yes, I get it, you've put in the work, but there have been plenty of times where your success came not from hours in the seat, but it came from conversations on the street. It came from interactions on the golf course, you know, chats during a gala celebration. Wherever it was, you had just as much success and opportunity and possibility and advancement from the non-backside in the chair, tapping on the keyboard, experiences. And so why not embrace the fact that that is one way by which we contribute to the success of the organization, but it is not the only way?
Well, I mentioned earlier that one of the things I thought was just so fantastic about the first book was the organization and structural framework for how to create that customer experience. Talk to me a little bit about the organizational framework and the phases involved in the employee journey and where they relate and if they relate to similar steps in the client experience.
So what's interesting, Neil, is when I set about to do this research, coming out of my first book, I had identified 8 phases of the customer journey, and that the research showed that the first 100 days of the relationship with a customer was the most important time in the entire client relationship. Those first 100 days, the foundational experiences that you laid, the deposits in the karmic bank account, that's really what determined whether you would retain a client long-term or not. So when I came into the employee side, I had that framework sitting in the back of my head, but I wanted to approach it objectively. And what I started to realize in the research is that employees were leaving with a similar frequency and time frame as the customers were leaving. In fact, depending on what industry you were in, somewhere between 20 and 70% of new employees were deciding to quit their jobs before the 100-day anniversary of their starting at the company. This number was staggering to me. The average across all industries is 45%. 45% of new employees will not make the 100-day anniversary. Now, this
I
number-
I saw was, that. I was floored by that.
It's staggering. It's staggering. Yeah. And what happens is lots of times, Neil, when I talk to a business owner, especially a business owner who has maybe 4 or 5 employees, they'll say, well, all of my employees have been with me longer than 100 days. And I'm like, great, but think back to the last employee who quit. When did they quit in relationship to their start date? Oh, well, now that you mentioned it, Joey, they quit pretty quickly. Or in some ways, what's worse, they had been here for 4 years and they were hugely valued and a linchpin in our organization, and then they quit. That's equally as bad, right? If you're losing...
And somewhat more costly.
And somewhat more costly. So either way, employees leaving is bad. Employees staying, employees continuing to contribute is good. And so we looked at the journey of the employees and I identified that there were a very similar 8 phases. Now, the 8 phases, I'll give you a quick overview. They all start with the letter A. And the idea behind this is kind of like if you were to give your employees a report card on how you were doing at every step in the journey, it's like getting straight A's from your employees. They love it. You're making law review. You're feeling good, right? So here are the 8 phases. The first phase is the assess phase. This is where a prospective employee is trying to decide whether or not they want to come work at your organization. They're doing interviews, they're checking out your job listing, they're checking out your website, they're going through all the process to be considered as a candidate. We then come to the accept phase. The accept phase has 2 parts. When the organization accepts that this is the individual they want to make a job offer to, and when the candidate accepts that job offer, they transition from being a prospective candidate to being an employee, they sign on the dotted line, they're committed. We then come to the affirm stage. Okay, in the customer side of the conversation, we refer to this as buyer's remorse. Allow me to introduce your listeners to a concept they may not be as familiar with, which is new hire's remorse. It's the same thing as buyer's remorse in the sense that a new hire begins to doubt the decision they just made to come work for you. They wonder, should I have negotiated harder for a better salary package? Should I have asked for more vacation days? You know, I was interviewing with a couple different firms and I accepted the offer from your firm because I hadn't heard back from these other firms yet, but I wonder if I should have waited and gone with them. That doubt, that fear, that uncertainty, if we as employers don't address that and reaffirm the employee's choice to accept our offer of employment, we're never going to be able to close that emotional delta. We've got to do it right then. We then come to the activate phase, phase 4. This is the first day on the job, and it's the only step in the entire process that is limited to a single day of work. What is that first day on the job going to look like, feel like, and how is that experience going to set the tone for the relationship going forward? We then come to phase 5, the acclimate phase. In this phase, which can last from several weeks to several months, the new employee is learning your way of doing business. They're getting familiar with your operations, your communications, your cadence. They're meeting their coworkers. They're getting a feel for what role they play in the organization, what their responsibilities are, and what the expectations are that the organization has for their work product. We then, after they get familiar with that and they start to produce, come to phase six, the accomplished phase. This is when the employee accomplishes the goal they had when they originally decided to accept your job offer. Now, the typical employer, Neil, thinks, oh, well, what they're trying to accomplish is getting a paycheck. No, that's not what they're trying to accomplish. They want that. It's an important piece of the conversation, but that's not their end goal. Their end goal is probably something around autonomy, opportunity, possibility, a promotion, new responsibility, development and acquisition of new skill sets. We've got to pay attention to what each employee is hoping to get personally out of this relationship, track their progress towards those goals, and then celebrate when they accomplish them. If someone accomplishes goals within the organization, we have the privilege to move them to the next phase, which is the adopt phase, phase seven. This is when the employee becomes loyal to you and only you. The way we can test for if someone is an adopter or not is to imagine this scenario. Your employee who's been with you for a while that you think of as an adopter, their phone rings and it's a headhunter for another law firm saying, we'd love to have you come to an all expenses paid dinner with our senior partner to talk about your possibilities and your future career. If they go to that dinner, they're not an adopter. If they say, you know what, I'm actually all good. Thank you. It's so kind of you to make this offer. In fact, we should do a lunch where I try to convince your senior partner to come over to our firm. That's when we move to the final phase, phase eight, the advocate phase, where your raving fan employees become your recruiting force. They sing your praises far and wide, publicly and personally, to promote your firm, to promote your organization, not only to customers, but more importantly, to their friends and family and classmates from law school and previous associates at other places they work to come work for you. That's the advocate phase. Not every employee will become an advocate. But the way you keep an advocate, is to acknowledge and reward their behaviors around advocacy. So those are the eight phases. They, interestingly enough, play out across a similar first 100-day schedule. Usually we're in kind of the acclimate to accomplish stage by about the time we get to day 100 in the typical firm. And then if you keep them longer, you have the right to move them into the adopt and the advocate phase.
I love the framework. You know, when I read the first book, I think I was maybe in reading the third phase of the framework. And I said, I had to stop. But okay, because this screams to me, I need a spreadsheet. I created my spreadsheet and I had my columns for each phase, and down the vertical axis, I had the different categories of communication styles. And as I then went through the book, I was making notes about, okay, in my firm, what would I like to do? And in this step, in this phase, using this communication tool, what can I do to improve the client experience? And I see this just leaping out at me for the new book as well. It lends itself to really actionable steps. It's not just, you know, a lot of theory and case studies and look what looked like this company did. It lends itself to really taking action. And that, to me, that's the most important element of the process.
Well, I appreciate that, Neil. And that is certainly my goal behind putting this together. And it has been the response from pre-readers and folks who have put these principles into place already, is they're like, Joey, I was two chapters in, I was closing the book and I was doing things and I was making changes. And I'm like, oh, as an author, that is music to my ears, because my goal is this isn't a book that you read once. My goal is that this is a book you can come back to again and again. I don't want to be a just once and done author. I want you to say, wow, you know, we read Joey's book when we had 3 employees. Now we have 10 employees. We should go back and read it again. Now we have 20 employees. We should read it again. Now we're merging with another firm and we're going to go from 20 employees to 70 employees. Oh my gosh, not only should we read it again, but we should make all the, you know, leadership team from our new firm that we're merging with also read the book as well. And step into this, because the practical reality is the experiences that your employees are looking for are evolving. They're changing. And if you're not trying to keep a finger on the pulse as to what matters to them, you're missing a huge opportunity. If I may, Neil, a real quick aside to something I'm seeing, you know, we talk about kind of the history of employers, and you and I are both, how should we put it, have been in the saddle long enough that we remember when many employers started to talk about having daycare available their organization. That was a big move. Like, we're going to have childcare here in our company, here in our firm, here in our organization. What we are going to see in the next 10 years, in my estimation, is organizations offering elder care. We are going to see a complete shift, because we're seeing a shift in the demographics. Many of the employees who have left their jobs in the last 3 to 5 years have left because someone needed to take care of mom and dad, or in this case, grandma and grandpa. And the practical reality is the employers who recognize what is going on in their employees' lives outside of the workplace and build in mechanisms and benefits and support structures to help them navigate those aspects of their lives will find themselves with many more adopters and advocates than those who pretend that what happens between 5 p.m. and 9 a.m. doesn't matter to the firm.
I asked the question about, you know, framework and all that, because it's my response to the comment. I know that we're going to hear, "Hey, Joey, I'm trying to run a business here. I don't have time for all this touchy-feely nonsense. I hire the employees. I pay them a good salary. I expect to get something out of them." But I think what the book points out is that it doesn't take a lot, really. It takes a little bit of creativity and some thinking on your part. And, you know, it doesn't take a fortune to implement an employee retention program that addresses their personal needs.
Absolutely. And again, let's come back to the foosball tables. This isn't about paying them more or giving them more days of vacation or giving them free lunches. This is about caring about them as the human. Now, if that feels too touchy-feely to you, I would suggest you go spend a little bit of time looking in the mirror or talking to your therapist and asking why you don't like the idea about caring for other people. Where in your life you have not felt cared for that makes you have this belief system? Because here's the thing. We are in a marketplace today where there are fewer workers than there are available positions, and there is more competition for top performers. We are not in a situation like we've been in the past where, you know, there were five times as many law students graduating law school as there were available jobs for lawyers. That's not the case anymore. And by the way, with the retirement plans for many of your senior associates and partners over the next decade, the gap that you're going to have to fill is going to be even greater than the supply of new talent coming in. Not to mention that because of remote work, one of the biggest threats that many of my clients are dealing with right now is companies outside the United States coming in and hiring their team members to work remotely from the U.S. They're saying, look, we'll match your salary. We'll let you work remotely. You don't have to deal with any of that business of going into the office. And by the way, we're a company in France, so you get all the French holidays in addition to the American holidays. And somebody's now like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. That's your competition. It used to be your competition was the other law firm in town. Now your competition is every employer on the planet who's willing to have an employee that doesn't work in the same town where they live. And by the way, that number's only increasing. So I understand that you want to pay them and get good work for the money you're paying. I get that. But you're competing in a marketplace that is very different than it's ever been in your lifetime, and it's not going back to the way you thought it was or the way you believed was quote unquote better. Because here's the other crazy thing, and forgive me for all the rants, but was it really better?
No.
Right? I mean, let's
I'm old enough.
Stop and be honest. Right, yeah, you and I both, Neil. It was better. It was not better. So this waxing nostalgic for the way it used to be in law firms, there was never a golden era of law firms, right? It was like this was consistently getting worse. And now we have the opportunity to press reset and say, what would the ideal firm look and feel like? We do a great clients.
One of the great things that I get out of doing this podcast and being able to talk to so many law firm owners is to see how the firms that are really embracing change, that are really understanding that the future is not going to look like the past and that we have to reconfigure what the office environment looks like. And that starts everywhere from technology to workplace to, you know, the physical construct of the office, org charts and all that. The ones that are forward thinking are the ones that are prospering now, not going to prosper. They're prospering now. And I'll give a shout out to a friend of ours, Christy Zlakas, who's been on the program, Z Family Law, just here in Montgomery County. She's one of the most forward thinking attorneys that I've ever met. And her law firm is just blowing up because she has that mindset. She has that view that's espoused in books like your first one and now your second.
No, I appreciate that, Neil. And it's so true. I mean, the writing is on the wall, friends. Yeah. The organizations that are making these shifts, that are making these changes in how they relate with and treat their employees are the ones that are growing market share, are increasing retention, are increasing client retention, mm-hmm. and are increasing overall engagement of their staff. These are all things we want. And again, it's not rocket science to create them. You just have to think a little strategically and put in some time and effort. Not a lot of money, just a little focus and attention and intentionality.
Yeah, just reading some of the case studies, and these weren't even with the companies that had large budgets, they weren't doing really cost things. They were intentionally and strategically taking some small steps to address very personal needs, and it can be done. But anyway, listen. This, we're recording this a few days, few weeks in advance. Today is the podcast will go live on the 26th of June, and the 27th is the launch date for the book. So tomorrow
it is. So hopefully, if these topics sound interesting to you, if you want to look to enhance your employee experiences and really set your firm up for the future of work, give it a try. Check it out. There's an ebook you can if you're into reading it on a Kindle or a Nook. There's an audiobook if you've enjoyed our conversation. I read the audiobook to you, and then there's a hardcover copy that you can just take notes in, and it can sit on your shelf, and you can refer back to it at a moment's notice if you want to dive back into your employee experience. But yeah, my hope is that folks will find that the return on investment for exploring these principles, for adopting some of these methodologies and ideas in your firm will be so great that this will be a book that you see as a fundamental tool in the development of your practice now and in the future.
Well, I know that it will be, Joey. I'm very happy for you. The book's called Never Lose an Employee Again. You can order it, I'm assuming, as of tomorrow.
Absolutely. You can order it now. It's ready. You can pre-order. It's ready to go. You can pre-order it now. You can get it right away. And yeah, I hope you enjoy the book. And I so appreciate everybody being kind enough to listen into our conversation. And Neil, thanks again for all the great work you do in getting folks to think differently about the law firm business model and what they can do to create remarkable experiences for their clients, for their employees, and themselves as they navigate this wonderful profession.
When I get to learn from, you know, experts like you, you know, I feel just a tad, you know, smarter as a result. And that's good for me. I need a little improvement on a daily basis. So Joey, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us again today on The Law Entrepreneur. I wish you great success with this book. I know it will be, and I look forward to having you sign my copy. Well, there you have it, boys and girls, another episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I want to thank our sponsors for this episode, our good friends at Ruby. I can't say enough about Ruby. As you know, they've been my virtual receptionist for years now. Couldn't be happier with them, and I really urge all of you, if you need a virtual receptionist, that you give Ruby a chance. Also, Net Profit CFO, as I've mentioned before, Ryan Kimler was a guest on the program some time ago. I liked what he had to say so much, I became a client. And then after I became a client, he became a sponsor. So very happy about that arrangement. If you want to take your understanding of your financials in your law firm to that next step beyond just what your bookkeeper gives you back, give Ryan a call at Net Profit CFO. I don't think you'll be disappointed. If you enjoyed this podcast, do me the great favor of leaving a positive rating and review wherever you listen to your podcast. It really helps with the opportunity for us to get in front of other people. And until next week, I wish you all the best, and we'll see you again here on Law Entrepreneur.